Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast, and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Well, with your help, we're powering through 2014. We're staring down the barrel of March now. It's still a frozen February in some places, and wet and windy February in places like the UK. Boy, this year, what a year for weather. Something has been going on, and one of these days we might find out. We might find out what's behind it too. Now look, one of the markers of whether your show is getting somewhere, or whether you're just another still small voice out there on the internet, is in the caliber of guests you get. Some shows don't get them. We are starting to get the big names here. We've had a selection of them over the years. And this time, another indication that we are starting to be invited into the inner sanctum of it all is the guest we have on this time. If you're in America, I think I only have to say his name, and you'll know what this is about. Dr. Stephen Greer. If you're in the UK, you may not have heard of him. You might. By the end of this, you'll know an awful lot more. Now, Dr. Greer is a man who doesn't do a lot of media. And when he does, he picks it very carefully. He's been on with them all. I've heard him a number of times with the great Art Bell. He's been on with Larry King. He's done them all. So to get him on here, and we've been trying for 2 years and have now succeeded, is a bit of a coup. So I hope you enjoy this show. And I hope that you consider that it's worth the work that we put into it. Dr. Stephen Greer coming soon. Now, to set the scene, I want to tell you a little bit about him. He founded the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, CSETI, in 1990 to create a diplomatic and research-based initiative to contact extraterrestrial civilizations. 1993, he founded the Disclosure Project, a non-profit research project, and I think what it does is explained in the title. 1994, appeared in Larry King's TV special, The UFO Cover-Up. 1997, with other members of CSETI, including Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut who we've had on this show, he made a presentation at a background briefing for members of Congress. 1998, this man all the while was working as an emergency room physician. He gave that up in favor full-time of the Disclosure Project. 2001, he held a news conference at the National Press Club in D.C. that featured 20 retired Air Force, Federal Aviation Administration, and intelligence officers. 2013, Dr. Greer co-produced Sirius, a documentary covering his work and theories over extraterrestrial life and government cover-ups. Get the picture? Dr. Stephen Greer. What a guest this man's going to be. I am so excited about this. Thank you very much to Adam Cornwell, my hard-working webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. There wouldn't be a website there, www.theunexplained.tv, without him. It wouldn't look like that, and the shows wouldn't be getting to you. So, Adam Cornwell, a very important guy to me, and to you too, I hope. Thank you very much for your emails. Please keep them coming. You can send them to me via www.theunexplained.tv. If you want to send me a guest suggestion or some feedback, whatever you want to say about the show, I will get to see it. I know I always say that, but I do. And if you want to make a donation to the show, let me tell you that a radio career makes some people a fortune and makes most not a lot. I am in category two, so I need your donations to keep this work going, and you tell me that you like it, and I'm so gratified by that. Thank you. Please, if you can, make a donation to keep The Unexplained going. You can do that at the website www.theunexplained.tv. And one of the reasons you might want to do that is the guest we're about to hear. Let's cross to Virginia in the United States, and welcome to The Unexplained for the first time, and I hope it won't be the last, Dr. Stephen Greer. Dr. Greer, thank you for coming on.
I am happy to be with you today.
Well, I'm really pleased to connect from the storm-tossed United Kingdom to the snow-pounded, by the looks of it, United States, Dr. Greer. I think both sides of the Atlantic, this will go down as being a very memorable winter.
Oh, yes. Well, we just had last night 14 inches of snow here, and we're in Virginia, for goodness sakes.
Well, you know, you don't quite expect that. Maybe up in Maine, but not in Virginia. Not at this time.
Right.
Okay, now I think what we need to do before we unpick the various strands of your work is just to get a handle on you and who you are, because your career did not begin as a man questing after scientific answers like this. You're a medical doctor.
Well, yeah, I'm a trauma emergency doctor, so I ran an emergency department for many years in North Carolina, and so I at one point was chairman of emergency medicine there. And you know, in America, it's its own specialty. It's, you know, shooties and stabbings and car wrecks and burns and all that kind of thing. And while I was doing that, I got involved in looking into this question, which I'd had an interest in since I was a child, of what are these things that people call UFOs and why is it being kept secret? And one thing led to another, and well, here I am. So, but interestingly, when I was about 8 or 9 years of age, I saw a silver seamless disc. It had no moving parts. It had no rivets. It was astonishingly clear, middle of the day, with some friends in my neighborhood. And I knew I had seen something extraordinary because it didn't move away. It just kind of dematerialized and disappeared right in front of us. And, of course, my parents said, oh, yeah, well, sure, whatever. But at the time, my uncle was working on the lunar module, which I don't know, for those who are too young to know what that is, the funny-looking machine that we built to put the first man on the moon.
Yeah, made of what you call aluminum foil, what we call aluminium foil.
Yeah, so it's a very fragile thing. My uncle worked on that as a senior aerospace engineer at Grumman, which is now Northrop Grumman, the second biggest aerospace company in the world, out next to Lockheed Martin. And so I had a great interest in space, and of course I was a young child when he was working on that. But nevertheless, you know, I knew I had seen something space-related and something that was really extraordinary. And it ignited a lifelong interest in these matters. And as I began to look into it further, I began to realize not only were these objects real, but the secrecy was based on something that no one had figured out. And
well, you had a special connection, obviously, through your uncle. Did you tell him what you'd seen? And if you did, what did he make of it?
Oh, yes, I told him, and in fact, to the day he passed away, which was 2 weeks after Neil Armstrong did in 2012, he was very supportive of the work I'm doing.
Right, so he allowed for the prospect and the possibility that indeed we may not be alone, even though he was working on our exploratory effort down here.
Well, he knew. He knew we weren't alone, and he knew that it would do. I mean, you know, he was a very smart man. You know, the irony is that, you know, while the media relegates the subject to the rubbishing in the tabloids, as your Lord Hill Norton famously said in an interview we have of him up on our website, that people who want to look at his and other interviews can go to seriousdisclosure.com, Sirius like the star system, S-I-R-I-U-S, disclosure. com. It's all one word. And what you'll see are we have dozens of these sort of people who've come out and said, oh, well, this is taken very seriously in these quarters. And what I have found is that when I've done briefings with people at the Pentagon or the U.S. Senate or the CIA, it's actually taken very seriously. But it's, you know, its portrayal in the media has always been that it's just nonsense. And well, you know, high-ranking people in a position to know are not laughing. They're taken incredibly seriously.
I think you're dead right about this, Dr. Greer, because over here in the UK, I think you know, I think maybe Emily, who set that up, this up, told you that I work as a broadcast journalist. That's what I do. And
right.
I always think that we're starting to make baby steps forward and take this a little more intelligently and treat it a little more as grown-ups. And then every so often we get a story in the newspapers that shows we really haven't progressed at all.
Well, what people don't understand is that beginning in 1953, the CIA, and I have a document that proves this, made a deliberate effort to engage in what they call psychological warfare, to portray the whole matter as nonsense. And in fact, they even engaged Disney Studios, which, as you may know, did a lot of work for the Pentagon and the intelligence community in World War II. And they engaged Disney Studio to make ridiculous cartoons about little green men and this and that and the other thing. And this was actually done with malice aforethought to create a spin on the subject. To this day, makes it sort of topic non grata. You know, if there's a persona non grata, there, this is the topic non grata that you cannot speak about.
And from what I read, Walt Disney was a patriot, so he would play ball with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he was in the back pocket of the intelligence community and the later the CIA all the way until the day he passed away. So what a lot of people don't realize is that the connection between Hollywood and the intelligence community has always been very intimate, and as well as with the larger media. And so what you are left with is a very faint idea of what's really out there. But the irony is, and for example, a couple years ago, you know, we put on this massive press conference at the National Press Club, and we had 22 top secret military whistleblowers and witnesses to events and material dealing with UFOs, extraterrestrial intelligence. It was at the time the largest event that had ever been held at the National Press Club, and it was the largest event up to that point that had ever been seen on the internet live. And we had, you know, so much support for that. But the major media people got to me later and said, you know, we started getting calls saying, don't cover this too much.
From
and
whom? Who was making the calls?
From the intelligence community.
Really? Now, this is this is amazing that you say this, because I can remember Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM talking about this. I was listening over here online. I'd become hooked and addicted to all of this. I'd always been interested in these topics anyway. And I thought, this is it then. This event is going to be the one that blows the lid off it. And this is the one that the mainstream media cannot ignore. And nobody was more surprised than I was surprised. And of course, I'm a very small cog. I was working for the mainstream media, but as one person, what can I do alone? It was pretty largely ignored over here. An event of that size, and I found that, as you must have found it, enormously disappointing.
Well, no, I didn't. I wasn't disappointed, because I didn't have expectations to the contrary. In other words, by the time I did that event in 2001, I had already been the go-to guy to brief the CIA director for President Clinton, the sitting CIA director, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the head of the intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, frankly, members of your royal family, who I won't name. So the point I'm making is that it did not at all surprise me that there was an infrastructure in place to spin or take down the buzz. Now, what you have to understand also, the first hour of that event was electronically jammed so that no signals could leave the National Press Club building in Washington, D.C.
Really?
The contractor that had the job and hosts all the things for the National Press Club at that time, they were called Connect Live. They also hosted the Pentagon's internet events as well as CNN. They said they had never seen anything like it. The numbers of people online trying to see it used up, at that time, every T1 line in Washington. They said, but the first hour of it, nothing could leave that building. And of course, I had intelligence sources who told me the night before that the building was crawling with operatives, and that probably the event would be disrupted. And so they put it on a 1 hour delay, but nevertheless, it did get out. But as major media started to cover it, in fact, I heard one NBC anchor say, my God, this is like the real X-Files, but it's the real thing. They started to report it, and then it vanished. And this is something we've seen many times. Of course, we knew this was going to happen, because in 1991, we had gotten a document that had been during the first Bush administration described, and I have it up on my website, those of you who want. All this stuff is up there for people to see. We have a massive website, as I've said, Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S, disclosure.com, and we have a new film out called Sirius that you can see online. But we put this document up, and it's a document that describes that the CIA and other intelligence communities have people at every major network and every magazine and every wire service and broadcast network to alter, change, or stop stories. And I'm quoting. Now, when you read this the CIA document, it's chilling. Now, it got declassified, and then it got reclassified after I released it, but we still have it. Huh. And what's interesting is the naivete of the public. You know, what always surprises me is that people were surprised by anything that Snowden revealed. I thought that was just everyone would know that. Of course, they're listening to every single phone call and email. I was shocked that people were going, we're shocked. And I'm going, really? You know, but what's interesting, people have to feign shock in Washington. So the president has to act surprised when, you know, for goodness sakes, I mean, it's been very many years since there was any privacy. You know, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works said before he died, Ben Rich, he said, quote, there are no private conversations anywhere on Earth.
I think a lot of us knew this stuff was going on, and
yes,
we saw little tips of the iceberg, like newspapers getting hold of confidential conversations from the royal family and stuff like that, which were trotted out over here for titillation. But to recently discover the extent that the NSA has been partaking of our business, I think has come as a shock to a lot of members of the public. It's certainly not the fact that it was happening, but the scale of it is the shocker.
Yeah, well, you know, here's something that I have from sort. You have to understand, I have over 550 people who work now or have worked in the CIA, NSA, Pentagon.
Why are they talking to you if you have these people who are connected to you? Why do you think
they are true patriots, and they're shocked and appalled that this nonsense is going on, and they know that this is the biggest secret in the history of the human race. They know that what the reasons for the secrecy have nothing to do with our national security, but with an oligarchy, a kleptocracy of people who want to maintain the status quo of the macroeconomic order. And this is what, you know, when the Honorable Paul Hillier and I first met, this is what he and I first talked about, the Minister of Defense of Canada. And when he read my materials and he understood that it's a science and technology story, that when you see one of these so-called UFOs, it's a totally inappropriate name, by the way. They're not unidentified and they don't fly. But so they're objects. The O part is the only part of UFO that's legitimate. The rest of it was concocted after they knew that they were either extraterrestrial or the man-made prototypes based on studying so-called anti-gravity technologies, but basically the source of energy that are making those things move, and where an object can be at one point in the sky and in an instant later be 40 miles away on radar, which we have radar tapes to prove, by the way. This is not something you can do with a jet engine. So you're dealing with a whole new level of energy, propulsion, physics that has been kept secret since at least the 40s and 50s.
Well, in fact, one of the things you say, well, certainly one of the things I've read about you attributed to you, is that the NSA itself was formed initially to cover up Roswell.
Well, yes, and also the CIA was formed immediately after that happened in 1947. If you look to the date of the formation of the CIA and the Air Force forming separately from the Army Air Force, which is what it was in World War II, it was that singular event. When they realized that they had materiel that would advance what they already knew was going on in high physics. Now, remember, a lot of people think that these things that are man-made that look like UFOs that Lockheed has and my uncle's old company has, Northrop Grumman, and they do have them, by the way. They're very classified aircraft. They're not acknowledged. In fact, they come into the category of an unacknowledged special access project, or USAP, which is what we go into in my film, Sirius, which, as I mentioned, anyone who wants to see it can look at it. It's online. And what these USAPs are, these unacknowledged projects are, is that they do not get acknowledged to anyone who is not in them. So it doesn't matter if you're a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, they will not tell you about it.
So this is what they call need to know.
Yes, but it also doesn't matter if you're the president of the United States.
Really?
Now,
I'm sorry for interrupting. I do apologize, but I just want to just bring in one important point, and it winds us back just a few minutes, and I should have interrupted you before about this. But
no, please, go ahead.
When you said that you are invited by very, very important people to brief them, and some of whom you cannot even go close to naming, why do they, if there is this enormous cover-up going on, and it is sensed at every level that there might be, I don't understand the mechanics of how these people call you in to brief them. Why do they want you to brief them?
Well, it's, for example, let's go back historically, back in the 90s, when everyone remembers that we had a guy named President Clinton, who was our president for 8 years. His CIA director, when he first became CIA director, was asked by the president to look into this, into UFOs. And we have this acknowledged not only from Webster Hubble, who was third in command at Justice, but his own admission. So the CIA director asked, and of course this is a new guy, they come and go every 2 years, 4 years, whatever. And he knew the subject was real because he had had a sighting with his wife in New Hampshire in the 60s. So Admiral Woolsey, Mr. Woolsey, asked someone who had been following me around to my lectures and had seen the kinds of evidence I had collected to come up to Washington under cover of a dinner party, sort of a salon. So, you know, we have these salons, they call them, or salon, where you go and, you know, so there were six people there. It was me and my wife and the CIA director and his wife, who luckily was the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, and our host and hostess. And the host was a man who was very good friends with the CIA director. And so he brokered this meeting, as it were. So we go up there, and I thought it would be a very brief meeting because, you know, a cabinet-level person in the United States, certainly the CIA director, usually you have, you know, a 15, 20-minute meeting. This went on for almost 3 hours, during which I had the very unfortunate thing to learn that, in fact, the president and the CIA director were being denied access to these projects, that people, frankly, in my own family and other people that I had gotten to know intimately were working on. I said, well, how can this be? This is through the looking glass. This is nuts. But that was before I learned, and then later I had a man who helped me through this system to learn what an unacknowledged special access project is, how real secrecy operates. And by real secrecy, I'm not even talking about the NSA programs that Snowden talked about. That doesn't even begin to reach the level of secrecy we're talking about here. So that's when I learned that this whole universe of unacknowledged special access projects that had grown up in the 50s, that Eisenhower warned us about when he said, beware the military-industrial complex existed. So I started digging and digging and digging. And so here I'm working full-time as a medical doctor and raising four young daughters. But I'm doing this as well I can with very limited resources. Now, very early on, there was the scion of the Rockefeller family. Lawrence Rockefeller took a great interest in what we were doing and had me out to his ranch in the Tetons. It's the same place where the Clintons would go to vacation in the early years of the presidency for Bill Clinton. And he was the friendly guy in that clan. Now, David Rockefeller, his brother, was horrified that Lawrence was supportive of what I was recommending, which was the termination of the secrecy, bringing out these sciences and technology, and getting our planet off of oil, gas, and coal, which is what would happen as soon as it was acknowledged that these things are real.
Well, gee, how many vested interests does that challenge?
Yeah, well, it's about $600 trillion in fossil fuel reserves, coal and gas, and infrastructure and utilities and the internal combustion engines and jet engines and rockets. All of it is rubbish, by the way. And all of it's been rubbish since the 50s. So the secrecy is really centered on the science and technology being kept under wraps, because if it were to be allowed out, as Lawrence Rockefeller turned to me, he turned to me on his deck there in the Grand Tetons. You know, the Rockefeller family owned the entire Teton Range and gave it to the U.S. government as a national park. But they kept out this beautiful ranch that I would go to. And Lawrence turned to me at one night out under the stars, and he looked at me. He says, you know, no aspect of life on Earth will be unaffected. So vast and profound are the implications of this disclosure. I said, yes, Lawrence, that's why it's been kept so secret. It hasn't been kept secret and ridiculed because it's trivial. It's because it's so profound. And he says, oh, yes, of course. But of course, you know, many people, and by the way, there's historical documents. Recently, the Associated Press sued the Clinton Library and got documents proving that these meetings took place. But at that time, it wasn't called Disclosure Project, which has now become quite well known. It was called Project Starlight, was a code name. So I'm up, here I am as a young doctor, schlepping back and forth between my work in Washington doing these briefings. So one thing led to another. So now, when a group of leaders get together and they want to know what's going on this, I'm frequently asked to come in and provide them information.
Do you think, Dr. Greer, that some of these people are using you as a conduit, because they know that you are heavily involved in this. You are very well known. You have access to the media. You have your own following. You write books. You're essentially doing their dirty work by revealing these things. You're doing what they can't do.
Oh, yes, and I don't know if I've ever said this publicly. Well, I have said this publicly, but nobody is caught on the nuance of what I'm about to tell you, which is really kind of shocking. But back in the early 90s, a man who's with a PhD scientist with the science directorate of the CIA sent a man down who he works with very closely, who's in this committee. It's been called Majestic or Magi or Magic. It has a new name now that I'm not going to discuss. Down to my home. And basically said, we want to meet with you. And I said, about what? Because I was doing this just as a kind of, not a hobby, but, and he says, we desperately need, this has to come out. We're running out of time as a planet, and everybody knows it. I said, well, why don't you do it then? He says, because it'll kill us. But you're just a doctor. Nobody cares. You're not important. And
couldn't you reverse that argument, though? Because quite important people. They would be noticed if they were killed. Maybe you wouldn't be, because a lot of people do disappear.
People do disappear. Now, at the same time, someone else from the intelligence community said that if you do this, you have to become well-known, so you need to get on Larry King Live, and you need to do all this, which I did. So, but the truth of the matter is, he turned to me, and I was, of course, flabbergasted. I'm going, well, this is the most upside-down, absurd thing I've ever heard. He says, you don't understand. We can't do it, because if we defect from inside, the rules of an unacknowledged project is that you kill anyone who breaks silence. But if you do it and start gathering the things that you can and bring it out there, that can create enough public education so the public becomes aware.
So they're using you to gather a critical mass.
Oh, yeah. And so after, here's an even more hilarious story, is that after I briefed the CIA director, one of Clinton's good friends who was sort of a fundraiser for the Democratic Party in America came to our home, and he was sitting around our table, and we were having dinner, and this guy's sort of a overweight, funny, jolly, kind of jokester kind of character. His brother frequently would sleep over at the White House with the Clintons, and he looked at me and he says, well, the president is very supportive of what you're recommending, which is to end the secrecy on this, but everyone around him is convinced if the president does this, he'll end up like Jack Kennedy. And so I start laughing. And, of course, my children are very young. And he stops me. He says, Dr. Greer, I'm not joking. I said, oh, come on. I said, well, don't talk about this like that in front of my children. You'll scare them. Let's talk about this in the library in my house later. So we go to the library of my home. And he says, they really are concerned for the safety of the president if he pushes on this. I said, are you kidding me? And he says, no, I'm not kidding you. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, well, we think you can do it. And I said, well, what you're saying is that I'm expendable. It doesn't matter if something happens to me. He says, that's right, you're expendable. You're really not important. So people
To hear that about yourself, how did that feel? I would be a little scared.
Well, no, I accepted at that point that I was the sort of the throwaway person, that my reputation, my career, my life, it doesn't matter in the scheme of things. So you have to have, on the one hand, you have to have a strong enough personality, which anyone who's gone up against me will tell you that I will absolutely take you down. I don't care if you're a general. But on the other hand, you have to have enough true inner spirituality and humility to say, well, in the scheme of things, they're right. I really am not that important. And it's the information, it's the knowledge, it's the direction and the arc of our society that is important. Because right now we're headed to hell in a handbasket over a cliff. But, you know, this information, the fact, A, that we're not alone in the universe, and B, that there are sciences and technologies that in one fell swoop could give us a completely new and sustainable civilization, this is non-trivial. This is of critical importance. And so you then begin to realize, however, and this was the hard lesson I learned back, you know, a couple of decades ago, is that the people who have all this power and money, they don't want to rock the boat. So it has to come from people like you and me. And so it has to come from we the people. It's interesting because I'm here in Virginia, just down the road from Thomas Jefferson's house, where President Obama and Hollande, the president of France, were just there this week. And it's just literally 20 minutes down the road from my home here. I have a home in Washington, but I have this farm out in Virginia where I am today, snowbound. And I think to myself, well, you know, it is about we the people. It is about us making this change. Now, I will admit that back in those days, I thought, well, if I put all this evidence together, the documents, the testimony, the photos, the video, the people, the good people who are in the Senate of the U.S. or the United Nations who I met with, and when Boutros-Ghali was Secretary General, he and his wife took a huge interest in what we were doing, that they would come together as leaders, world leaders, and do the right thing. Wrong. I was quite naive. So now what I've concluded is that in point of fact, everyone asks me, when is disclosure on all that's going to happen? I said, it's happened, and we're doing it, and it's continuing. In other words, we the people are going to gather the data. We the people are going to find patriotic people to expose the truth about this. And with the internet now and other media, alternative media sources, like your show, we're going to get the word out. And that's what we're doing.
But so the problem, you can't be surprised that a lot of these big-name politicians around the world didn't get together and hold up their hands and say, ladies and gentlemen, here is the truth and we're going to march into a new future. Because if they did that, we enter into a whole new power equation, don't we?
Well, that's the whole thing. The secrecy here's the when you deconstruct it down to brass tacks, just what it's really about. It isn't about extraterrestrial intelligence, and it's not about UFOs per se. It's about the macroeconomic order of the world. And you know, at Davos a couple weeks ago, I have a friend who I work with who was there, and they came out with 80. There are 85 people who have the net worth of 3.5 billion people on Earth. 85 individuals. Before that, a couple years ago, a Swiss institute, a mainstream Swiss economic institute, found that there were a couple hundred corporations and individuals, but that are interlocked to about 17 that have the majority, over half of the net worth of the world under their belt. And so what you find is that this all tracks into the petrodollar energy sector and other aspects of the economy. If you bring out a technology where every home and business and car that under the hood of your car, under the boot of your car, you have a device that pulls energy out of this so-called zero-point energy field, which has been proven scientifically to exist, by the way, and you no longer need ExxonMobil or BP or the coal mines or the public utilities or what have you, first of all, aside from the fact we would end climate change and pollution and all the poisoning of the Fukushima-type nuclear reactors, we would have every single village in India or Africa or South America or China have the ability to have complete self-sufficiency. But with that macroeconomic change, the centralized economic system will go the way of all flesh. And that is what they're protecting. They're trying to maintain what I call the master and slave arrangement that we inherited from the slave era, of where basically, if you're a millionaire, it doesn't really matter. Until you start talking trillions of dollars, we're not talking real money. Bill Gates is still a relative slave on this plantation. The real money is in the multi-trillion dollar banking and fossil fuel energy sectors, to trillions and trillions of dollars, and I'm not exaggerating. So that's where the power and the money is, and they do not want to upset that apple cart, which if you were to tell people, yes, the UFOs are real, and not only that, we know how they operate, you're talking about such a big change that if you were to look at everything that's happened since the Industrial Revolution in the mid-1800s to now, all the changes from the mid-1800s to now would be less than this disclosure. So now, on the other hand, it would lift it would be the tide that lifts all ships. It would eliminate world poverty probably in a generation. It would cause all kinds of beneficial effects. But as I was recently invited to a gathering of 120 world leaders on an island out in the middle of nowhere, which I won't talk about in more detail because I was asked not to. And I was given the keynote on a Saturday about this. And the title of the entire conference was From Disruption Opportunity. So the way I frame this is that there's a huge opportunity if we get this right. If we don't make this change, what are we facing?
But Dr. Greer, you keep talking about us and we and the powers that be down here and those moneyed individuals and the president and all the rest of it. In this whole equation, though, the ETs seem to be passive. And if they have such power, and if they have such wisdom, and if they have such technology, how come they are not part of this? Why don't they do the disclosing?
Well, you know, here's the thing. We're the children of Earth, and we're the prime movers on Earth. If there were to be, yes, and, you know, I head up what's called a CE5 teams, and we now have several thousand of them in England also, by the way, where we go out and attempt to make contact with these civilizations, and we have done so. If you go to the website, you'll see some pretty shocking information and experiences that have happened.
Well, apparently this stuff has been happening in the north of Scotland. Certainly one of my guests here tells me that way up sort of Lossiemouth way, where there's an Air Force base, there are all sorts of things going on all the time, I am told by him.
Well, but here's the thing, is that the extraterrestrial civilizations know that if they were to come in and just force these issues, it would be more disastrous than America going in, along with the United Kingdom, trying to create a Jeffersonian democracy in Afghanistan on top of a feudal society that's locked in the 600 and 700 AD period.
And why do they care about that? Why do they care about the way this is done?
Because if it's not done right, it could be more damaging than being kept secret. So the reason it has to be done by humans is that we are at a certain state of our evolution, both spiritually, socially, in consciousness, and technologically. We need to do this ourselves without a massive intervention that's extraterrestrial, unless it gets so far gone that it has to be. Now, I wrote a position paper back in 1991 that got circulated all through the aerospace industries, McDonnell Douglas at the time, which is now Boeing, and my uncle's company, and the CIA, where I basically said there are a few conditions under which a massive event like that would happen, but they are worst case scenarios, which we certainly don't want to entertain. Massive geophysical collapse, a massive thermonuclear exchange such as mutual assured destruction, where you have thousands of nuclear weapons flying and destroying all life on Earth, and things that are really truly apocalyptic.
But at the moment, we're making a great job of screwing this planet. Look at Fukushima. I don't believe we've been told the whole truth at all about that. Look at the state of climate change.
That's horrific. Mm. However, you know, from what I've observed, there have been instances where the ETs have intervened where people don't realize it, to stop worst-case scenarios from developing, such as a World War III scenario with nuclear weapons. But they're waiting for us to get this right. So I think they're waiting for us to quit lying to each other. They're waiting for us to tell the truth on this. They're waiting for us to bring these technologies out at a level that can be phased into our society and understandable. And they're waiting for us, more importantly, to reach out to them in a peaceful way. Unfortunately, you have a bunch of misanthropic money whores and sociopaths running the covert programs now that would rather shoot at the ET craft than do anything else. So there's a lot of problems here that have to be addressed, and they have not been addressed for 50 years. And as we kick that can down the road, our society has continued to deteriorate, as has our biosphere, and they know it. But it doesn't mean that and looking into the future, will there become a point where they will do some definitive event? Perhaps, but remember, we had events where there was a UFO over Montreal for 45 minutes, seen by thousands of people in the early 90s. We've had events where these objects have landed and left physical evidence and been seen by thousands of people in Belgium. There have been many events. Now, the fact that our power structure, including the corrupt media, have covered these things up or trivialized it or lied about it, that, I believe, is sort of a Rorschach test by these intelligences that are from other star systems to see how ready we really are. In other words, to the extent that we're continuing to cover this up and lie about it, is some measure of how prepared we really are to deal with it.
You say this and with such assurance, and you make a very, very compelling case. What about your contact? You say that you've been amongst these groups of people, including here in the UK, who've been trying to make contact. Talk to me about that.
Well, this is, of course, the subject of part of the film deals with this whole question of what would be required to make contact with these civilizations. Now, I had an experience when I was young. I told you this sighting. And then subsequently, when I was 18, I had another experience that was more profound that I recount in a book that's called Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. It's sort of autobiographical, and you can get it on our website. It's in 8 or 9 languages around the world now. What happened, I know we have limited time, was basically I was up on the mountaintop in North Carolina as a young boy in college, first year of college. And I was up on this mountain, and I was meditating. And I had learned how to do this really deep meditation, Vedic meditation, after I'd become very sick 6 months earlier and had a near-death experience. And during that near-death experience, because I was raised as atheist, and my family were atheist, agnostic, they didn't believe in anything, that you couldn't put into a test tube. And basically my experience was that of the personal experience of the mind as a universal field of universal consciousness, very mystical, some would say, but very tangible. So I learned meditation so I could experience that more deeply while still being healthy and alive.
Well, according to some biographical material about you, it says you found the Rosetta Stone of ET contact, the power of the unbounded mind that we all have.
That is exactly what happened. So once what I was about to tell you is that I was doing this meditation, and just before the meditation, I saw the same ship that I had seen when I was 8 or 9 years old, a beautiful silver disc. It was right before sunset. And I just sort of acknowledged it, and then I did the meditation. I had a very deep meditation, after which I had a contact experience where an ET being appeared on my right side and touched my right shoulder. All my hair stood on end, and back then I had more hair, and it was longer.
We all did.
I basically sort of moved into another dimension, for lack of a better word, with this being on a craft, where we then went into this deep meditative state and kind of co-created the protocols that I've now been teaching for about 20 years that involve the ability to remote view space and these civilizations by first going into this field of consciousness that, as Erwin Schrodinger, the father of quantum mechanics, called mind. There's the total number of minds in the universe is a singularity. It's moving into the experience of that singularity, the oneness of that state of consciousness. And it's quite beautiful, but it's also very practical, because what happens when you enter into that state is that you're then able to actually awaken to another point in space or another point in time. Now, of course, the pop culture called this remote viewing, and the CIA has had projects dealing with this. But what I've done is turned this into a diplomatic protocol where we utilize that ability to make contact for peaceful purposes with these civilizations, and then after we see where they are, we turn it around and vector them or guide them into where we're located, whether it's in the mountains of Colorado or in Joshua Tree National Park or in near Stonehenge in the UK where we were last year.
So literally you're using this technique and you're almost like taking a calling card, a cosmic calling card to them saying, hello, here we are, come and visit us.
Yeah, and they do. And we had, you know, the photographs and videos and the experiences our teams have had are amazing. But the reason it works, and this is the punchline of this, and this is one of the comical things that happened when I was meeting with the CIA director and his wife. She was a scientist, and she asked the question, well, how are these civilizations communicating across the vastness of interstellar space? Because, you know, your cell phone is traveling at the speed of light. The signals are radio waves at 186,000 miles per second. Well, you know, even to get to Mars when it's far away from us takes an hour at the speed of light. It's too slow. So if you're talking about light years, you're talking about if a planet is 1,000 light years away, which is very nearby in our own galaxy, it would take 1,000 years to get a signal there and 1,000 years to get it back. So it's just too damn slow. So the speed of light is too slow. You have to begin to study what I call transdimensional physics.
And does this mean we need to stop pointing telescopes out towards the stars because what's out there, you know, them out there, they're not there. They're way beyond that.
Well, that's the thing. If they arrived here from another star system, a priori and by definition, they have mastered transdimensional physics, meaning they are moving out of 3D into other dimensions to get from point A to B. They're not making a straight line. They're going from point A to B by going through infraspace, if you want to call it that, or transdimensional space. It gets quite obtuse to some people and abstract. But the point I'm making is there is a physics that we know and understand quite well. But ultimately, the ultimate field of transdimensional communication is consciousness and thought interfacing with a device. And so the experience I had when I was quite young was that these civilizations think to an instrument and it does something. Now, we would call that magical, but if you took a cell phone or an iPhone to Thomas Jefferson 200 years ago here at Monticello, he would think that was magical and from a completely fantastical. So the point I'm making to people is that we're dealing with civilizations that can interface with what I call coherent thought, just like a laser light is coherent light where you sync up all the green wavelengths of light. You're dealing with thought emanating from a deeper level of consciousness that's coherent in a group, and that will then interface with their electronic systems, but they're not electronic systems like being made in Silicon Valley. They're very advanced.
And if they are so staggeringly advanced and so amazing, as they certainly sound, and they can communicate one with another, why are we so backward?
Because we've chosen to be backward. It isn't that we don't have the hardware and the software and our consciousness and our minds to do this. It's we've limited ourselves by our own belief systems. And I think this is part of how we need to awaken as a civilization. Part of this is a technological story. A deeper part of it is a very human and spiritual story of why have we kept ourselves running around like troglodytes, pretending like we live in a world of scarcity, when in reality, as Tesla said, the universe is made of infinite energy. So, and abundance. And I think that part of this is our desperate need to have a different framework and paradigm of how we view ourselves. Not only do we have to go beyond viewing ourselves as one race or tribe or religion as humans, we have to go even beyond humanity to realize what does it mean to be sentient? What does it mean to be conscious? What does it mean to be awake and intelligent in this universe today? And when we begin to ask and answer those questions, we're going to find that our future is more different from our past than today is from cavemen.
But the only problem there is, and it depresses the hell out of me, and maybe you feel this way too, I'd be keen to know, is if you look at the equation, the number of people who get off on reality TV shows and, you know, Dancing with the Stars and all that, versus the number of people who want to explore their sentient capabilities, it's no contest, is it? Which side wins out?
Yeah, well, we live in a period of deliberate, what we call in the film series, bread and circus, basically, the shock and awe and drivel of our current culture. But that doesn't mean that that's where everyone really is. In other words, there's about 25% of the population now that are deeply interested in these things. But if you look at, you know, the work of Rupert Sheldrake, who's one of your colleagues there, I think he's at Oxford, and he and I have, you know, been at conferences together where he talks about morphogenic fields, where once a certain number of people begin to understand and know something, it creates a quantum change in everyone understanding it, even though they're not connected personally.
And that is utterly, I've always believed that. When a concept appears, and when somebody appears to espouse something, suddenly you find other people are doing the same thing. It's as if you have the idea somehow, and I've seen this in my own life, you have an idea, yep. And suddenly you look around, you find other people are having the same idea. How did that happen?
The reason for it is that mind and consciousness is non-local. It's actually omnipresent. And this has been proven in physics. And so, you know, this spooky effect that Einstein talked about in physics that goes way past quantum mechanics has been proven to exist. But when you're dealing with humans and civilizations, that's very much the case. So what we need to do is create a trend line into this kind of consciousness and understanding. And we're looking for, as it were, our 100th monkey. Because, you know, they've done these studies with tribes of monkeys on islands that are separated. When the 100th monkey or so, and it's a percentage effect, but the reason is that it's non-local, and so it can propagate that way. Now, of course, the trend line is not really very edifying right now, as you mentioned, top-rated shows like, you know, rubbish like Duck Dynasty and, what, you know, morons falling into the swamp out of the rowboats and whatnot.
Oh, dear, but look, television's full of it.
But it's full of it. But at the same time, not everyone is enthralled to that.
But what you're saying is that if enough people become enlightened or try to become enlightened, what will sweep from them like a tidal wave, a tsunami almost, is this greater consciousness that will even enmesh these pretzel-eating people who sit on their sofas staring into the box, into the
it'll turn the direction of things. For example, when I first got involved, I became a meditation teacher, and at that time they were doing some experiments at Harvard in the 70s. Now biofeedback and doing meditation for stress management in heart patients has become mainstream. It's very well known. So there are things that happen, but someone's got to start it. So we have to pioneer the concept of not only contact using these concepts in trans-dimensional physics and consciousness and disclosure, but also the concepts in physical physics, energy generation, a new way of looking at a paradigm of energy and society that is off of this destructive dinosaur era where we have to get energy by burning or blowing things up.
If you know what this technology is, this energy technology is, and you know people who know it, what this is and how it works, why don't they just demonstrate it for us one day? Then it is undeniable.
Well, that's, of course, what we're trying to do. Part of the purpose of our project is to gather together enough resources so that the scientists who understand this can come out and do that without worrying about the patent issue and security by doing it openly and on the Internet. Now, I'll tell you, the way that we did this in the past was that we would give them a grant, they would work on something, someone would come and threaten them, and because this is an engineer working alone somewhere in Alabama, they put their tail between their legs and run. So if you have people who are willing to use lethal force or to use the legal system to, you know, we have a document up there from the Federation of American Scientists that came out 3 years ago that states that there are 5,135 patents that have been confiscated by the abuse of the national security order system in the United States. Same thing has happened in Europe. So you cannot do this like a conventional technology. So what we're advocating is that we put a research and development program together, get it funded properly. We have a way that people can contribute on our website to this. Put these people together and then put it on Ustream or stream it on the Internet. In other words, don't worry about intellectual property.
Because there's strength in numbers.
Because if the public knows you are working on this and have it, it's going to be very hard for them to suppress it. That's what I did with the Disclosure Project. Once we had dozens, I mean, I had 110 of these top secret guys on digital videotape, and we started putting it out there. What can they do? They can't. It would become a public spectacle if they started prosecuting and killing all those people. So you have safety in numbers. You have strength in numbers. We need to do the same thing with this technology. The big error of the last 50 to 100 years is that you've had people like Stan Meyer or Tesla or other people who've had breakthroughs, and they've tried to keep it secret, and they've tried to, at the front end, monetize it through some kind of venture capital scheme. Ultimately, that's a disaster. It will not work. And anyone who's listening who's working on such a project, stop it right now. Go to our website and read the strategic plan that we have under the Orion Project of how to do this properly and not get killed.
And do you think that the modern concept of crowdfunding, which they use for movies and creative projects, could be used in exactly this context to make this happen?
Well, it's a bit of a chicken egg. If you want to crowd it, fund it, you first need to have a proof of principle prototype. To get to the proof of principle prototype, we need to have that. Have I seen them? Yes. Have the people who have them been too paranoid to release them? Yes, and that's the problem. You know, a venture capital guy once told me the craziness of the inventor is proportional to how important the invention is. So once you get into this, you get into real what I call crazy inventor syndrome. And they will not cooperate with something because they're looking to get a big payday up front, which is a huge mistake. Not that I don't understand it, but it's a huge mistake.
I know this is not your field. Do you think that some of these patents relate to time travel? Which has always fascinated me.
Well, it does relate to my field because I know the people who work on these transdimensional programs for the various three-letter agencies whose laboratories I have been in, by the way, at the Naval Research Labs and at the Redstone Arsenal and down near the Huntsville Space Flight Center. I've been to these places. They absolutely do. They can create what's called a time snap, and we understand how it's done, and you have to be careful with these technologies when you start moving them into the levels of the millions of volts of certain resonant frequencies that cause a change in space-time.
So that, is that what I interviewed Al Bielik, and you know, I'm one of the lucky people who got the chance to do that before his sad death. I think it was a few months ago, in fact. And you know, I was very, very grateful for having that conversation. He put a very credible case that the Philadelphia experiment really happened and they really did shift in time. Is that part of this?
Sure, but it didn't happen in Philadelphia. B, it's most of what most people know about it isn't true. There was a cover story to the cover story. This gets very complicated. And do I know the knowledge and people who were actually involved in that who, before they passed away and who were in their 80s, gave me the yes, I do. It's a bit of a sideshow, but yes, and some of it went badly wrong, as you know, but that is exactly what we're dealing with. And you're dealing with technologies, and that was in the 40s, by the way. So you know, what I tell people is that we're 70 years into covert programs looking into these things, or more, probably 80 years. T-Towns and Brown, of course, had high-voltage systems causing crystalline materials to levitate and float back in 1927, 28, and 29. So we're way past what most people think we are, where, you know, if you and when you start getting into that sort of technology, you do deal with transdimensional physics, where the physics from this dimension begin to cross and create an arc and an effect in other dimensions that are folded within this one. It's not like they're separate, you know, like you have to go somewhere. They're here. But look at it this way. You as a human being are transdimensional. You have a physical body. You have consciousness and thought. You have this subtle body that on a lucid flying dream you can go somewhere and see something happening. Maybe even into the future, a precognitive lucid dream. So in reality, all these dimensions are folded with it. It's hidden in plain sight. Nobody's looking.
I never thought I would ask you this, but do you have a handle on what happens when we die?
Sure, absolutely. And I am not, well, let me just say that I personally feel that one's religiosity, one's spirituality is inversely proportional to one's religiosity. So the more pious and religious someone is, I found, the less spiritual they really are. But that being said, when I was 17 and got very sick from something that's really not important, I had an injury and got terribly infected, and in America, we have no healthcare system for poor people, and I was so poor. I was supporting myself in high school in my own little apartment, and so I didn't go to the doctor, and so I got a fever, a very high fever, and then I had a near-death experience. And I have no question at all that at the time of the dissolution of the body, the conscious body continues on into these other dimensions that are increasingly astonishingly beautiful, if your consciousness is beautiful. So, but so the world is as you are, and it's quite astonishing. So, yes, I do have a good sense of that.
Geez, so you're not going to be rescued and taken to a better place. You're going to be taken to what you deserve, unless you do some real preparation down here right now.
It's not what you deserve. That's too judgmental. You're going to be where you are.
I understand.
You're going to be okay. Where are you? Which is, of course, one of the whole problems with people who commit suicide. They're in a very bad place when they pass out of this dimension into the other.
Geez, so you're going to get more of the same unless you're very careful.
Yeah. So yeah, ultimately, and that's why that's a non-solution to any what problem you're having on this planet. But that experience was something that. Obviously, I came back, but the experience of it was so beautiful, and the experience of what the conscious mind is and what we are was so amazing. But it was without all the trappings of the overlay of a sort of a religious belief system, because I was frankly raised an atheist and agnostic. My parents didn't believe in any of that. And yet, what I've come to realize is that there are these so-called other dimensions and worlds of light, and even into the what some people have termed the celestial, that are very real. Now, what's interesting is that these interstellar civilizations understand this very well, because if you begin to get into the technologies that cross into other dimensions, you begin to bump into things like the mystics used to call the astral universe. Because really what you're doing when you go from one star system to another, you're skirting between the along the underbelly of the 3D cosmos and crossing through these other dimensions that are increasingly, shall we say, pure consciousness and thought. And that's what's amazing about the contact experiences our teams have had. A lot of people say, oh, God, they sound so abstract. I said, no, they're more real than sitting in the living room with someone. But it's very strange. But you would expect it to be very strange if you're dealing with an interstellar technology.
But you talked at the head of this conversation about the role of Hollywood down the years. And, you know, we started off by talking about cartoons and Walt Disney. It sounds to me like Contact, a movie that I love with Jodie Foster, was not too far short of the mark.
Yes, and of course the ending of that would have never been made if Carl Sagan had been alive, I'm told. But I had dinner not long ago with Steven Spielberg's son, Max Spielberg, and that he did a movie, you have to be of a certain age to know it, called Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
I remember it well.
And that was actually a docudrama. And in it, of course, there is a protagonist that has this connection that's in thought and consciousness, somewhat telepathic, with the ETs, a Richard Dreyfuss character in that film. But it was actually based on actual cases that Spielberg studied, and he was given access to some files at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where the Roswell materials went. And I know people who worked on the film, and I also know that when it was shown at the White House with Ronald Reagan stood up at the end of it, and he says, there are only a couple people in this room who know how true to life this film really is.
He was connected, wasn't he, in a way that other presidents maybe haven't been. He really was into this.
Well, he was, because, you know, as governor of California, he had a sighting when he was flying from on the governor's plane from Sacramento, I think, down to L.A. And as was Jimmy Carter. Remember President Carter, who I recently saw at the inauguration of Obama, the second inauguration last year. And what was interesting is that Clinton knew that these other presidents had an interest and had sightings. And Carter had specifically stated when he was running for president that when he became president, he would end the secrecy on all this. And I have the report form that President Carter filled out when he was governor of Georgia when he saw one of these objects when he was governor. But when he was governor, president-elect, the outgoing CIA director was a man named George Bush, the senior, Papa Bush. And he was called in to do this transitional presidential briefing, which is routine. And Carter asked to be briefed on the UFO subject, and Bush said, I will not tell you about that. He didn't say it didn't exist. He says, I'm not going to tell you.
And Carter accepted that.
And Carter was furious. No, he did not accept it. If you look at the Disclosure Project material, he initiated the White House study on UFOs, but eventually that was shot down, and it was going to be done by Stanford Research International, SRI, and all sorts of people got involved with that I know. But ultimately, Carter couldn't really get any information on it. And subsequently, people think he's joking when he's been asked about this. And Carter says, well, apparently I didn't have a high enough security clearance.
And what about Barack Obama? I get the impression, just by looking at the man and listening to his day-to-day policy announcements, that he hasn't even been there. He wouldn't even venture into this arena.
No, I mean, speaking honestly, there's a man who works closely with him named John Podesta. John Podesta was the chief of staff for Clinton. Podesta set up the Obama administration, and early on, about five years ago, when Obama first took office, I was asked to put together a briefing, which was given to Mr. Podesta for the president. The cover letter for that briefing is on the website for anyone to read. The rest of the content of it is hundreds of pages and enormous amounts of video and documents that were provided. Now, providing information to someone like that, it was like when I was meeting with a member of the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee back years ago, Claiborne Pell. And Senator Pell and I were talking. I said, you know, you've been denied. He says, I've asked about this issue many times, but I never get any answers. I said, no, they're not going to tell you anything, even though you've been on the Senate Intelligence Committee and you're chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. I looked at him, and we're out on it's interesting, we were right next to the Skywalker, George Lucas's ranch out in California, and I'm looking at Claiborne Pell, and I said, you know, Senator, you have been deprived of dealing with the ultimate foreign relations issue. And I point to the stars above our head is at a dinner party. And the senator looks at me and says, well, Dr. Greer, I'm afraid you may be right. I said, well, I am. And he had a very keen interest in all of this, but he had never been told anything. And this is the real tragedy of the modern era, is that, as Eisenhower warned us, the military-industrial financial complex took this stuff over. It has never been under proper oversight by people like Senator Pell, who would have been wonderful ambassadors from our civilization to these others. I worked for years with Ambassador Jim George of Canada, who was a wonderful, enlightened man, very good friends with the Dalai Lama. And he and I spent hours and hours and hours together and out under the stars. And I said, you know, we need to have people like you doing this on behalf of the governments of the people of the world. He said, yes, but we're never going to know anything. I said, well, then let's do it ourselves. So that's why we're doing it now with our little ad hoc sort of citizens diplomatic effort making contact. But in reality, it is a tragedy when you think of the people that I personally have met with who would have been wonderful ambassadors and emissaries from humanity to these other civilizations. And instead, they know nothing. They're not told anything. There's a criminal enterprise, to be honest with you, in the United States, United Kingdom, and other major countries, keeping this secret, who all they want to do is shoot at these ET craft and try to down them to create a war scenario.
All right, which is the point that we started at, which brings it rather neatly round at the end of this conversation. Do you think that if you restage that event that you held in 2001, wasn't it, 13 years ago, at the National Press Club in D.C., more people would listen?
Sure. I think the thing is that what I found is that with the internet and with the new media, You know, when we first announced this film, Sirius, there were 5-6 million people who were reading all of it. It was the top story on the Huffington Post. Well, if you're on the top-rated show on CNN, you're lucky if you have 1 million people look at it.
Yeah, these days, yeah.
So what I'm saying is, it's a bit of a paper tiger. You have to reevaluate. So what we're doing is to be able to reach more people. Now, whether or not, quote, the mainstream media will ever allow it to be carried any further than it already is, I don't know. But what we've done in the last few months, if people go to seriousdisclosure.com and click on evidence on the top bar, you're going to see witness testimony. You click that on and there are something like 5 or 6 dozen top secret militaries witnessed there that we have edited and put up for anyone in the world to see free. There it is. So same thing with government documents, same thing with photos and videos, on and on and on
so
and on.
In this world, things have moved on. We don't need a news conference.
Well, exactly. We you know, been there, done that, bought the T-shirt. And here's the other problem, is that I was just on the phone yesterday with someone connected to one of the big cable network TV shows, and they said, look, we want to do something that's based on your research for a reality TV show, but we don't know if the networks will allow it. I said, well, I doubt they will. And then he went on to tell me that they were doing something on a show that it was a big cable show on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the network killed, they're very tied in, all the networks are very tied into the Pentagon and CIA. They were going to have the people talk honestly why they had PTSD, and a lot of it was because of friendly fire, when we kill each other in warfare, or when they had to do things that ended up killing innocent children and civilians, and that it caused such PTSD for these soldiers, and they would not allow that to be in the show, and they killed the show because of it.
So if that gets suppressed, what you're talking about is going to be absolutely stamped on.
Well, so yes, exactly. What I'm talking about is 1,000 times more of a challenge to the status quo than some poor guy who's lost 2 of his limbs, who has PTSD because he, you know, witnessed, you know, his buddies being killed or by friendly fire or killing a bunch of children in a village in Iraq. But my point being that, you know, this is part of the mythology that everyone has bought into, that we have a free press, we do not, that we have free markets, we do not. How do you have a free market if there is a behemoth that is suppressing the biggest technological innovations in history that deal with energy generation and propulsion? We don't have we have a managed free market economy, but it's managed. We have a limited free press. So all these things are conditional and qualified, but the people, because we buy the sort of the PR of the master. But the PR of the master is saying, oh, we live in a democratic and free society. Well, this is a bunch of rubbish.
Do you know what? I agree.
Well,
I work in the media.
Well, it's just absolutely a fact. I've seen it up close and personal. Mm-hmm. And and Hollywood is no better. If you want to create another movie with shoot 'em up with aliens in space, that you can get funded for $200 million, no problem. If you want to do a movie that's the true story of this, you can't. That's why our documentary, you asked about crowdfunding, the Sirius documentary, which anyone can see online right now, is the number one crowdfunded documentary in history. It still is the number one crowdfunded documentary in history in terms of the public supporting it and funding it. We did it in 11 months from the time we announced it to the time it came out, you know, 8 or 9 months ago. So what you find is that there is a new way of doing this, because if you try to go through the traditional system, you're going to run into this buzzsaw. And I remember meeting once with a very big director producer in Hollywood who wanted to do a true feature film about this, and he was boasting that he had $60 million discretionary from his studio to do any movie he wanted. I said, well, you know, he had writers in there from, you know, who had been on the X-Files and all kinds of. I said, well, great, let's do it. He flew me out, we had a chat, and he was one of these very typical big Hollywood moguls, $1 billion movie guy. And I said, okay, great. I said, I don't know that they're going to let you make this movie. He says, oh, I have complete control over this budget. I said, great. 2 weeks later, he calls me up. He says, Dr. Greer, I'm afraid I can't do this film. I said, well, you know, I thought you said you had complete. He says, well, not for this. So, you know, I've seen this firsthand. This is not a conspiracy theory at all. Forget theories. I only deal with facts. And I had the head of ABC News. He was the producer for 2020 and Primetime Live. When he saw the Disclosure Project news conference in 2001, which is just less than 12, 13 years ago, he says, "This is the biggest story in history." I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "We're going to do a whole series of things on either Primetime Live or 2020 at ABC News." I said, "Great, I'll cooperate, but I don't think they'll let you do it." He says, "I'm the executive producer." And I said, and in New York, I said, "That's great." So he brought me up there, and I met Sam Donaldson, all these guys. And a couple weeks later, he calls me up very sheepishly, and he says, "Dr. Greer, they won't let me do this story." I said, "Well, Ira, who are they?" He says, "Dr. Greer, you know who they are." And that's how we left it. So that is a true story. I have it documented. You know, people go, "Really?" I'm going, "Yeah."
Well, so, as we wrap this up, yeah. And I'd love to talk with you again. If I know you cherry pick very carefully. You pick your media outlets very carefully. So I know that, you know, I'm grateful to do this. I want to repeat this because there's a lot more we can talk about. But
we've just scratched the surface.
That's all we've done. But What happened to me, I had Paul Hellyer on when this was a radio show that was on AM radio that went all over the UK and all over Europe at night. It was a Saturday night show, and you know, I'd been interested in these things for years, and I'd heard Art Bell, and I thought, I can do this. This is my time. I am a journalist, and I want to do this stuff.
Right.
And I've been interested in it since I was a kid. So we did it. We did it on the radio. But after I talked to Paul Hellyer, I came out of the building one night with my producer, Dave, and I know I've told the story on this show before, but it's true. In a road where on a Saturday night late, there is no traffic and no people. Opposite was a black, you call them Jaguar car, British car, and two guys wearing black suits who looked like the Blues Brothers. And on the dash of that car, on a little stand, was a camera pointing at us.
Sure.
And, you know, I am convinced somebody was interested in what we were doing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I could tell you 1,000 stories like that. When we first started this project, and I'm working as a doctor, and one day I picked up my phone to dial out, and they had left their hook on my phone open so I could hear the control room and all these people talking. And I said, I was so outraged. Now I just take it as a matter of course, but I was so outraged. I said, "Who is this?" And a woman with a very thick accent said, "Oh my God, it's Mr. Greer." And I said, "Dr. Greer to you, bitch." And
you sure it wasn't Lily Tomlin on the switchboard?
I laugh at these things. Wife and I laugh at these things now, but it's like, you know, it's you accept that when you're dealing with this issue. A, it really is real, and B, the most powerful people in the world want to keep it secret.
Mm. Well, that's a good point to park this conversation. Stephen, I'm very, very, if you don't mind me calling you Stephen, I am delighted.
No, please,
I'm really pleased you did this. Please come back on here and just tell people again the prime source of contact for them if they want to see what you do.
Yeah, they should go to seriousdisclosure.com. It's SIRIUS. Disclosure.com, and there's the movie is there, film series they can see, and there's all this evidence. If they click on the evidence bar, there's these events where we go out under the stars at night. Those are posted up there, and there's also an app. If you have a smartphone, you can download an app that will turn your phone into a magnetic field meter and has all the meditation protocols and all the instruction to do the close encounters of the fifth kind, as we call it.
I like the sound of that. We've got to repeat this experience. We have to
do
this again. We've been in this conversation. We've been to places I had no. Normally, I have an idea of where we're going with a conversation. We've been to places I never thought we were going. Stephen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm not going to say anything after that. Dr. Stephen Greer, we waited 2 years, a lot of persistence and a lot of effort, and I'm really, really pleased we did because it was well worth it. If you want to give me feedback about Dr. Greer's contribution, if you want to make one of your own, go to www.theunexplained.tv. That is the place that you can send me an email, feedback of any kind, a guest suggestion, whatever you want to do. And the website designed by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Thank you very much for your support. In every way, you really have powered me through this last year, and you're going to lift me up and take me forward through 2014. Many, many thanks. You know how much I appreciate that. More big shows coming soon here. Until next we meet on The Unexplained, stay safe, stay calm, and stay in touch. My name is Howard Hughes. I'm in London. This has been The Unexplained, and I will return to you very soon. Please take care.